Star is Born is opening in October, and this is the, it's a remake, but it looks like it's a remake of the 1976 Streisand movie, and I wanted to talk about all of the A Star is Born that we currently have out.
So we're going to be here like for an hour?
No, I'll make it quicker than that.
Settle back and reach for the remote. It's the Cube Critics Podcast.
I have to admit,
whenever
I think of A Star is Born, and this is indicative of when I grew up, I immediately see an image of Kris Kristofferson and Barbra Streisand, that poster.
In that clinch.
In that, which, I'll lay it on the line here. It represents so many things that were wrong. I mean, not by them. I mean, they're wonderful people. But just society, that just represented so much of society at that time. And it just makes me kind of cringe just a little bit. But anyway.
All right.
So there I've said it.
It was, it is an iconic image.
Yes, it is.
If you don't know what we're talking about, we're talking about topless Kris Kristofferson and topless but artfully posed.
Demurely.
Barbra Streisand clutching each other.
And she is looking up just adoringly at him, and you're not quite sure where he's looking.
Yeah, it's a great image.
Yeah.
It really is. It's powerful.
Very powerful.
Not as powerful as the movie, but, it's a powerful image. All right, so A Star is Born began in the 30s, and it was a...
How many versions?
There have been three versions so far, and this Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper one will be number four. So the original one is set in Hollywood and not the music industry, like the Streisand one and the Gaga one that's coming out. And it's based on, it was a story that was put together by William Wellman, who's a director, and Robert Carson, who was a screenwriter who really didn't really make anything big after that. And then they turned it over to Moss Hart and to Dorothy Parker and a few others to put it together. And so the basic storyline is a young woman who's named Esther Blodgett dreams of being in Hollywood, and her grandmother has belief in her and sends her, scrapes together some money, and Esther goes out to Hollywood to make it, and she's not making it. And then she meets Norman Maine, screen star, played by Frederick March. Frederick March of Racine, Wisconsin, apparently. Mm-hmm.
But the dreamy Frederick March.
Incredibly dreamy. And he's handsome, he's worldly, he's drunk, he's witty. Anyway, and he's a pain in the butt. So he's...
But still dreamy.
And they meet, and they've got some chemistry together that builds in where it really feels like they really do fall in love. He just loves Esther Blodgett's innocence, how positive she is, and she's in love with him just because she finds him worldly and charismatic and funny. He's very witty. I mean, Dorothy Parker's writing all his lines, so of course Norman Maine is very witty.
Great one-liners,
It is a great version of this movie. It is still
original.
Even though it's 80 years old, the zingers feel, the one-liners in it feel true, the gimlet eye that it has on stardom. I mean, it's 1937. Stardom hadn't been around that long. I mean, there had been theater stars in the 1800s. There have been people who were famous somehow. But really, screen stardom and having a manager and having the press on you was pretty a young industry at that point. And it is a sharp critique of it and of what it takes to be famous and the people that kind of hang on and prop you up. And then when you're on your way down, just are so happy to be stepping on your face as they climb higher. It truly, truly is romantic. And it's truly tragic. Their relationship really feels bone achingly sad when Norman starts drinking again.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I could give this away. Norman keeps drinking, people. It's a tragedy. When it was remade, the weird thing about it was, it's Judy Garland and James Mason in the remake, directed by George Cukor, who had done The Women. He's a great director. And Garland, it was her comeback. She hadn't been in a movie since Easter Parade in 1950, so it's 1954. This is going to be her big comeback. And she was a fragile drinker and drug taker. So she's making this movie about an ingenue who is in love with a man who can't stop drinking. Meanwhile, she herself is the one dealing
with it. She's wrestling her own demons.
And her performance is just, it's very Garland. It's, you know, quavering voice and, oh, everything is fine. Norman's in the sanitarium. It's so painful to love. You know, just the over-the-topness of Garland that I adore. They had filmed it almost completely, and then they refilmed it because they wanted it in CinemaScope. So they when you're watching it, they spent a lot of time with this and a lot of time with each other. The musical performances are Garland at her best, and she sings The Man That Got Away. And she's just, you believe, she's such a, if you were casting a movie, like let's cast someone who's going to be a Hollywood star. Judy Garland, it's hard to believe she was a star. I mean, she was such an incredible actress, and she's such an incredible musician. Musically, she's just amazing. But she's a funny-looking little thing, and that's what makes
her
so...
But she has presence. I mean,
she has such presence. And so it didn't seem that crazy to have it be Streisand, someone with incredible, like a superstar and presence. So they moved it. Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn, her husband, co-wrote the screenplay for the remake in the 70s, and they set it in the music industry, which gives you access to the awe that you can get with a big musical star. You know, they've got a scene at a stadium filled with people and Kris Kristofferson singing, and it's just a gigantic seeming palette. But, and Streisand is a great performer, but you watch it now, and she's so Broadway and Broadway comedian. She's just like the quick zingers and the quips that she's supposed to have that Dunn and Didion write. She just delivers them like, well, let me tell you about, you know, she's just so broad.
And there really are, musically, I mean, in their own right, they are from such different worlds, too. I mean, Kris Kristofferson coming from more of a, I don't know, what do you say, country and western
side. Yeah, country, yeah.
And, you know, an extraordinarily accomplished musician in his own right. And then Barbara Streisand. And you kind of, I mean, that's maybe going back to that poster, looking at it, going, how does this work?
Yeah. And it does, they don't have the right chemistry for it. They don't have, you know, Kris Kristofferson looks like he's just checked out. And not because he doesn't know how to do drunk and charismatic at the same time.
Well, it is
I
hard.
Think is the problem. Frederick March can do drunk and charismatic. James Mason can do drunk and charismatic. And Kris Kristofferson just looks kind of bored and sleepy. But it
which is a turn on for some.
Yeah, bored and sleepy. A lot of people like that. But the whole environment of the 1970s and watching the clash of cultures of Broadway star Streisand trying to act like she could be a rock chick with Kris Kristofferson, who was kind of a moody singer-songwriter of a country star, trying to act like he had been a kind of a swinging rock god, kind of like Led Zeppelin or something. It's just such a weird mishmash. It still works because it's so kitschy and because a couple of the songs really are great songs, but it is more of a joke to watch it than the other two. The other two are genuinely great dramatic romances, and this one is a interesting misfire, sometimes in epic proportions. Apparently, John Peters, who was a hairdresser, who was the inspiration for Warren Beatty's character in Shampoo, and then he started dating Streisand and got into making films. He was a producer, and apparently he just kept insisting, they talk a lot about her ass. You know, and there are all these shots of her butt, apparently, because they're trying to figure out, I don't know if they're trying to figure out a way that they could explain why Kris Kristofferson is drawn to Barbara Streisand when she's a nobody, and they keep talking about her butt, and there are a lot of low cam, that camera that's kind of about 3 feet off the ground, trailing, and so you get a lot of shots of Barbara's butt. Just misguided.
Yep.
doesn't quite work.
Two questions then for you.
Yes.
And I don't know which order you want to take.
Okay.
Then, first of all, predictions for the new one?
I am fascinated that this is Bradley Cooper's directorial debut. So many actors choose to make something that's smaller and more intimate where they can really... I mean, he's starring in it still, mm-hmm. but he's taking on a big, scary project because there's so much to measure against. The first two movies are classic films, and the third one is a classic kind of awesome disaster. So to try to... I feel like the first one really talked about addiction. They both talk about addiction, the horror of being in love with someone who is an addict. And I feel like there's so much more that can be done with that and modern takes on it. And I'm interested to see how that works. Plus, Bradley Cooper's just this huge film nerd, cinema nerd. He mm-hmm. just loves movies. And I love Lady Gaga. I adore her. And to see her acting is going to be fantastic. I'm really excited. I would never have guessed that it's supposed to be one of the best movies of the year. I never would have thought that until all the Toronto people started talking about it. And the one that really amazed me, Wesley Morris, who's just, if he likes a film, it's going to be a great film, and it's going to be an interesting film. And he apparently loves this movie.
Interesting.
So I'm hoping that it's, I don't know, that it harkens back to the early ones, but then with Gaga's talent and her singing ability, that musically, and it can delve into the artfulness of Esther Blodgett / Vicki Lester in a way that really also leapt out in the Garland version, where her talent is so obvious and over the top and magnetic. I just can't wait to see it.
So the second question,
yeah.
the age-old question, which I know, I think they've been complaining about this since the 50s or maybe even the 40s, the whole idea of remakes.
Oh, come on. It's been like 40 years. It's not like they're remaking. It's been years.
But yes. But still, there is, of course, the idea that there are only, five stories?
Or yeah.
And so there's bound to be some repetition. But the dangers of making a movie that's going to be held up to, as you said, two classics and a classic mm-hmm. disaster, and classic performances, individual actors mm-hmm. playing maybe not the same role, but kind of the same archetype. And from a viewing point of view, from a movie fan point of view, what do we gain from this?
You gain a new vision of addiction. You gain a new critique of what stardom is like now.
We're hoping we're going to gain.
Yeah. And I love it when if it's successful, and there's so many. I love Gaynor and March because Gaynor also had been in Sunrise, the masterpiece of early cinema, playing the fresh-faced farm wife whose husband leaves her. And then you see her in A Star is Born against Frederick March. And it's that history you have with these characters to see what they do new with Vicki Lester / Esther Blodgett, how they make allusions back to Frederick March, James Mason, or God help us, Kris Kristofferson. And I just love that. If you deeply know a work of art and you see somebody updating it, playing with it in an intelligent and true or sincere way, which I think that they really are, it's exciting.
So fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. Oh, my God, I can't wait.
That wasn't quite an hour.